This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 378 for May 19th of 2017. Kia Niro? Yeah, it's got a hybrid. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Mr. Vasilash.
John, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Good.
Hey,
good.
That was a great show last week with 92-year-old Floyd Weisselak.
Yeah, it really was. He's an interesting guy.
Yeah, we got a lot of great feedback on that show.
And it's amazing, this industry. I was at an automotive steel conference yesterday. 1,500 people.
Unbelievable.
It was crazy.
Just talking about steel.
Just talking about steel all day long, talking about steel, welding steel, forming steel, you know, using a laser, steel. You know, we have a car here that's made out of steel. I mean, it's amazing. But I mean, to see the enthusiasm in this industry about something that, you know, we just sort of take for granted.
It's been around for almost 100 years.
Yeah. I mean, it's just wild.
Okay, we got to let everybody know that Christy Swinesburg from Ward's Auto is also joining us for today's show. Christy, great having you here.
Thank you for having me, John.
Great. How do you feel about steel?
Oh, I love it.
There you go.
Yeah, I can live without it.
That's great. But we've got to let everyone know, too, that we've got Steve Kozowski here with us. He's the National Manager for Strategic and Business Intelligence at Kia Motors America. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John.
And I see we've got a Kia Niro in the studio with us, too, which was what Gary was alluding to, that
yes.
We've got a car made out of steel.
Mm-hmm. 53% advanced high-strength steel.
You read that, yes.
I did.
That's right.
Yeah, it's all, you know.
Yes. 53% high-strength steel. What is also cool about the car is it has an aluminum hood and aluminum tailgate, and it's part of a whole mass reduction strategy we've implemented on the Niro. When we created the car, fuel economy was so, so important on that car. So there's a lot of ways you have mass reduction, you have thermal efficiency, you have aero, road load, tire drag, things like that. But the structure of the car is about 53% high-strength steel, and then lots of bits and pieces. Some chassis components are made of aluminum. The bumper beams are made of aluminum. So the whole mass reduction story is really, really important part of the car.
So you guys started with a clean sheet. I mean, this is an all-new platform.
This is an all-new eco-car platform. It's
And explain that eco-car platform, because I think that's an important part of the story.
Yeah, good point, John. So the origin of the car goes back to about 2011, 2012, and the directive from our leadership was to create a Kia eco car. And the bits and pieces in place related to the powertrain, the battery, and a lot of other elements. But one of the things that's key is the architecture of the car. It's not derived from another car in the lineup. It's not an iteration of another car. The platform was designed and engineered from the beginning to accommodate batteries in different sizes, to accommodate hybrid powertrains, EV powertrains, and so forth. So all of those, all the engineering work that went into the architecture of the car, the rails, the floor pans, all that, the structure of the car, originates from having to accommodate these different powertrains.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of surprised me. I thought, you know, the size of it is about the size of a Forte, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to learn that you guys said, no, we're gonna start from the ground up and build this.
Right. And so that's a key point, though. But, you know, the car is sold in global markets. It's sold in North America, it's sold in Europe, and it's sold in Asia. So that, from the beginning, sort of defines the footprint and the shadow of the car. And the C-segment car, you know, be it a utility vehicle or a sedan, is the most popular vehicle around the world, roughly speaking, in terms of volumes. So that sort of defines the size of the car. And then from there, you have manufacturing constraints, a lot of other different things. But it's sort of coincidental that, you know, the wheelbase is 2,700 or 106.3, which is really a common wheelbase in C-segment cars. It's same as Forte and Civic and Sentra and a lot of other cars that are in that space. The track width is a little wider than a Forte. The overall length is a little bit different. So, but the general shadow of the car is about the size of a Forte. But the platform architecture and a lot of other bits and pieces and components are completely unique to the EcoCar platform.
Mm-hmm.
So I know you share this platform with Hyundai. How did you get the crossover and they got the car?
Yeah, that's a very good story. So again, back to 2011, 2012, the conversation was about the Kia Eco car. What should it be? And the code name for the car is DE, which is Dedicated Eco. And invariably, you know, in these programs, there's a lot of sharing between the Hyundai brand and the Kia brand. You know, they're all in the same family. Mm-hmm. And we really, from the beginning of the program, did not want to do another Prius, an Insight, an Ioniq, a Leaf, a Volt, that whole sweeping, fast aero cam-back shape. We did not want to do that. And
was that based on customer feedback?
That is a combination of customer feedback. We'll tell you about that in a second. And also, we wanted to be distinct within the marketplace. You know, Kia has some CUV, SUV heritage. We think there's some merit in that. And we really sensed that there was this secular change in demand toward utility vehicles out of cars. And this is back in 2011, 2012. And we really pushed and pushed and pushed. There was a key meeting we had in early 2012 with our leadership in Korea where we basically got the whiteboard out and said, guys, vertical line is fuel economy. The horizontal line is going from sedan to utilities. There's this big wad of highly fuel-efficient cars over here, and there's not much up here. We think there's a great opportunity for a highly fuel-efficient utility vehicle. Enough. We want to go here. This is where we want to go. And, you know, roughed out the basic dimensions and who we thought the key competitors were. And that directive became the origin of this car. And it's worked out wonderfully. And it's interesting, when you do consumer research, when we did research back then and you do it now, when you do focus groups, you'll hear a lot of resistance to the wedgy, super aero shape. I don't want that car. I don't want to look like that. Can I just get 50 miles per gallon, carry my stuff, my bikes, my dogs and whatnot, and feel good driving the car and look cool driving? I don't make a statement. And we think we made the right decision. Yeah, we're pretty confident in that.
Yeah. You've also taken a very different approach with your hybrid then, mm-hmm. right? You mm-hmm. know, it shares the same powertrain with the Ioniq, mm-hmm. does it?
That's right.
So no CVT.
No CVT.
You guys have gone with a DCT transmission instead.
That's
so
right.
Go into a little bit of the thinking on that, because I got to tell you, I think you're going in the right direction.
Thank you very much. So one of the things, a couple things drove that decision. One is efficiency. So the DCT is innately, 5-7% more efficient than like a planetary automatic. That was one, but it feels different. And if you were to just step back and say, what are some keywords that apply to an ECVT? Mushy, sloppy, soupy. And if you look at a DCT, it's crisp, engaged, sporty. And one of the things we also...
But bad launch.
Well, it takes some very careful software and tuning to get that right. But the launch also is enhanced with the electric motor.
Mm-hmm.
So that's...
Well, that's what I'm getting at. I've driven, you know, the Ioniq, and that's what so much impressed me about the car,
mm-hmm.
is even though CVTs are making great progress, mm-hmm. they still have issues,
let's put it
that way. The approach that you guys have taken does not have that mushiness, and you don't have the launch problems with the DCT.
That's right. Yeah, so you take the torque converter out, and then on a normal car without a torque converter, you got nothing until it comes on cam, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. But with the electric motor there, you have instant torque from zero RPM, so that fills in where you don't have the displacement or the torque converter to provide the torque down low. So that really works well.
So you're talking about doing consumer research for this vehicle. Now, you guys have the Sorento, you have the Sportage, which are more conventional crossovers, uh-huh. than this vehicle.
Uh-huh.
So what is the demographic, psychographic, whatever graphic that is interested in this vehicle?
So what we're getting is, right now, I can tell you the demos, it's about a 52-year-old male making between $80,000 and $100,000 a year. Those are the fundamentals. What they're trading in typically are Soul, Sorento, Sportage, Forte, and Optima. Those are the top five cars that are coming in. That's about 40% of the demand for the car. The other 60% is Conquest. And guess what the number one non-Kia trade is?
Prius.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
But is that because there's so many Priuses?
That may be part of it. There's also... some aversion to the new Prius, you could put it that way. And it's interesting, when I go to mykiaforums.com and just read what people are saying about this, there's lots of wonderful threads and discussions in there. But one of them is Niro versus Prius. And it's interesting to read through there and see what folks are saying. And a lot of it is, there's a couple things. One is, here's a typical discussion. I had a 2004 Prius, liked it. I got a 2010 Prius, liked it. I saw the new car. I really don't like the design. And beyond that, they lowered the hip point. The car handles better, but getting in and out is more difficult. The Niro is, you know, about 2 inches higher than a typical C car. So not only is it higher than a typical C car, it's higher than an Ioniq, but it's also way higher than it is in a Prius. And that's good for ingress and egress. Mm. Plus, it has a certain aesthetic that looks and feels quite different from a Prius.
Yeah, no, I think you guys have gone the right approach of making it more mainstream from a styling standpoint. Mm-hmm. I think you open it up to many more people in the market.
We think so. It was designed in our Irvine studio. The guys who did it, Joey Moe and Mike Torpy. Mike Torpy did the sole. Mm-hmm. So both of those guys have such a good, so talented on the shapes and the forms and the proportions that make the car look and feel crossover-like, and the surfacing is very crisp and robust. You look at the bumper forms, and it's interesting when you overlay this car with an Ioniq, and you look at how short the front overhang is and how short the rear overhang is, and how consumers read that. And it just makes it look a lot more crossover, CUV-like, and rugged and tough. Hmm. Yeah.
Do you consider the RAV4 hybrid to be a competitor, or is that a little bit bigger than...
The RAV4 hybrid's bigger in overall length, but it rides on a shorter wheelbase. So we have about almost a 2-inch longer wheelbase than it, but it's a good 8 or 9 inches longer in overall length. But if you look at the cross-shopping, yeah, it's definitely in there. Less about the hybrid RAV4, but more about the RAV4 in general. But yeah, I was going to say, but, you know, those cars, the CR-V, the RAV4, they get cross-shopped against everything.
Right. Yeah.
We got a question here that just came in from one of our viewers. Dan Berry says, Hyundai and Kia plan to roll out small electric sport utility vehicles based on an existing platform in 2018, said Lee Ki-sang, who leads Hyundai Kia's green car operations. Range will be over 300 kilometers. He wants to know, is the Niro electric one of those?
We haven't said anything publicly, but I'm curious if y'all were the product planners for such a vehicle, how would you configure something like that? What do y'all think?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I would do an electric, a hybrid, and a plug-in hybrid all off the same platform and save some money.
That's an interesting thought, John.
Yeah. It is curious.
Good question, Dan.
It's curious with the popularity of crossovers that there aren't more electrified. Does that surprise you?
Yes. It does surprise me, and I'm personally just a big proponent of electrified utility. Mm-hmm. It makes so much sense, be it a hybrid, a plug-in hybrid, or an EV, for a variety of reasons. You know, the can height of the body allows you to package the battery under there. Mm-hmm. That's one, which innately helps the CG of the vehicle because that weight is down low.
Right.
The utility aspect of the vehicle allows you to charge a premium, which covers your cost and your material cost of the car.
Well, there's also a curious lack of minivans that are electrified.
And, this is true.
And you guys have an attractive minivan.
This is true. This is true. I have to keep an eye on Town and Country Hybrid and see how they do with that.
Yeah,
yes. Pacifica.
Pacifica.
We got to take a quick break right now. We're going to come back. We're going to talk a lot more about Kia and the Niro. But we got to give a shout out to our friends at Lear who helped make this show possible.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back talking about the Kia Niro. It's Steve Kozowski here from Kia. And, you know, one thing I've noticed in the television advertising, no mention that it's a hybrid. Now, there's one very quick shot where it shows the eco badge that says hybrid, but no mention of it. Are you involved in any of that decision of how it gets marketed? I mean, I personally think it's very intelligent just to say, hey, here's a cool crossover, and it gets 50 miles to the gallon, and never mention that it's a hybrid.
Well, the marketing folks have done just a wonderful job. The Super Bowl ad with Melissa McCarthy was number one.
So it
was hilarious, and we're really proud of it. I think we really wanted to sell the attributes of the vehicle. It looks great. It carries your stuff. And, you know, we heard this from consumers that, again, it looks great. It carries stuff. It gets great fuel efficiency. It drives wonderfully. And it happens to be a hybrid. And I think part of that messaging got into the marketing and promotion of the vehicle.
So, you know, you were mentioning that the Conquest cross-shopping Prius owners. Is it for a car like this that you no longer have to convince people to get a hybrid if they've already owned a hybrid?
Maybe. I think there's a lot of truth to that in the sense that the hybrid vehicle owner is already comfortable with the technology, and they get it. So there's probably something to that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Rory Senna just wrote in to say, why didn't you bring diesels to the U.S. or even a diesel hybrid? I'd buy one in a heartbeat.
Diesel hybrid, yes. Very, very efficient, but also very, very expensive. Hmm. Really expensive. And diesels, you know, the industry is going through a lot of scrutiny right now. We've looked at it again and again and again, probably since I've been with the company. We've had numerous different diesel projects and studies and analysis. And I think there's always the right balance of trade-offs between cost and fuel efficiency and emissions and market appetite. And, you know, every month we get the data, the Polk data, and look at, you know, how are diesel sales and how are things working. It's still a relatively small chunk of the market. And, you know, when you contrast that with what other alternative powertrains exist and what other technologies exist to improve fuel economy, reduce GHG, it's really tough sometimes to make the argument for diesels. I'm a fan of diesels. I love the torque, and they really work in some applications quite well. And we're not opposed to it, but we just need to find the right product and the right balance and the right compromises to get it through. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, you know, again, working with the EPA and the regulators to get that certified. Right now, just to get a car homologated takes a long time, and diesels are even longer now. There's a lot of scrutiny.
When you guys were developing this car, and you said earlier that this is a car for global market, mm-hmm. Were there certain things that you, as someone, you know, based in California, was interested in having that you had to push for to get into this car?
I think there were a certain number of pillars or fundamentals that we all rallied around. Of course, the design and the aesthetic. It had to read and communicate crossover and utility vehicle. That was one. The driving dynamics and the package, I think, were some other elements of this. But I think, you know, we believe people buy the car with their eyes first. So the aesthetic, the look and feel really needed to communicate this crossover utility feeling. And then, speaking of feelings, was the driving feel of the car. Again, we keep going back to how an eCVT feels, and we wanted this car to feel really, really different from that. And then, above all, was the fuel economy. You know, the getting a car like this to achieve 50 miles per gallon or more is tough. And that gets to a negotiation, a compromise, a working conversation with the engineers and finance about content and timing and this, that, and the other thing. So, you know, those are probably the three or four passion points: the utility, the design, the fuel economy, and the driving feel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How many of these do you think you'll be able to sell this year in the United States?
Right now, we're pacing at about 3,000 a month, so we're looking at about 36,000 a year. We want to sell more. All the dealers I've talked with about what do you need, what do you don't need, you know, this color, that trim, they just send me more cars. Mm-hmm. I need more cars. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting feeling because we'll look at the days to turn on this car, and it's really quick. And you'll talk to dealers. Early on, some dealers were like, it comes off the truck, we peel the wrap off, and here's the keys. Next. So it's really, they really need more. So my point is we're on pace for about 36,000. We can probably sell more if we can get more.
Yeah. So is this, I mean, to put this into some sort of context, okay, when you brought the Soul for the first time, mm-hmm. I mean, how did that sell compared to how this is doing?
That was the same way. And it's a really interesting feeling because I'll never forget that car came out when we were almost at the trough. Almost about 10 million units, and that was a time where we hadn't quite started the factory in Georgia. We were still selling some old product, and you know we were scrapping it out with the rest of the industry at the time, trying to sell cars, and we knew there was a lot of great product in the pipeline. But I'll never forget talking with the distribution folks who were saying these things are flying out of the ports. The dealers want as many Souls as they can get. Those are the things that are moving out of the ports as quickly as possible. And we originally planned that car at a much lower volume and then immediately had to start putting plans together. Okay, what's the real upside potential for the Soul? Instead of 30,000 a year, what about 60 or 100? And it was a really good feeling.
Do you think this is going to be analogous to that?
I don't know if it'll quite go to 100, but, you know, the appetite in the market for utility vehicles is so strong. I mean, every month we look at the sales numbers and you look at the compact car moving down and the entry and subcompact utilities moving up. And, you know, we're convinced it's a secular change, and I think there's upside potential for the Niro, just exactly how high, I'm not really sure. Yeah.
Okay, we got a couple more questions here. Jeremy Park says, and I don't know what this means at all, he says, have they mentioned the unobstructed rear window? Does that mean anything to you?
I might conclude that he's talking about the quarter glass or the backlight of the car. If he's talking of that, then, well, we're appreciative of the comment. Because
okay, and Joe Laszlo says, is there any suspension hardware or tuning that gives the Niro any off-road credentials?
Well, off-roading and utility vehicles, CUVs, is always sort of an interesting...
I mean, this is a passenger.
It's a passenger vehicle. Right. It has a higher ride height and a higher ground clearance, so... For sure. But in terms of, like, off-roading, like, different damping...
Not taking this to Moab.
No,
probably this is not going to do the Rubicon
trip. No, I don't think so. And, you know, the short answer is it's really been tuned for the street.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
you know, the thing I mentioned earlier that I actually drove a Niro to the studio today. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's driving down 275, going speed limit, and... how it kicked into EV.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
You know, I mean, it was phenomenal to be going 70 miles an hour and then looking down at the agency
EV. Yeah.
That it's EV. I mean, that
it's really cool.
Doesn't happen very often in hybrid vehicles.
Especially that speed, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool. And, you know, our whole powertrain system in this car just operates so completely differently from an eCVT unit that's in, you know, Fusion or Prius or something like that. So if the battery state of charge is sufficient, you can be driving along, and, yeah, you'll see the little EV light come on. And, you know, it's constantly blending the engine in and out. And this is what we were talking earlier about the DCT and all the software management to get that right. Because the software wants to prioritize electromotive force. It wants to use that motor, not the engine. So if the battery state of charge is sufficient, it's going to shut the engine down, but as soon as you put your foot into it, it'll restart that. So blending that engine and clutch and motor and DCT and finding the right gear right now is just, I have to hand it to the engineers. They should be like badged magicians because it's really amazing what they've done.
Can you talk about your interior concept for the vehicle, how you made a green, or did you make a green interior?
So it's not as green as the Soul EV with a sugarcane-based bioplastics, mm-hmm. and it doesn't use the volcanic ash that's in, or the volcanic materials that are in the
ionic.
In the ionic, right. But, you know, it doesn't, so to answer your question, it doesn't have the green or low carbon materials that are in the Soul EV. Mm-hmm. But the interior theme was really designed around a, you know, utility function in terms of space and packaging and the ability to put a bicycle. I can put my bicycle in there without taking the wheel off. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it's got a little bit of a driver cockpit feel in the way that the center stack is shaped, mm-hmm. and it's sort of a horizontal plane to the top half of the IP. Yeah.
Got another question here that came in from Christopher Wolf, who asks, just curious if you'll ever make an all-wheel drive version to compete with all the Subarus here in Colorado.
Well, That's a thing, isn't it? The all-wheel drive has come up all throughout the program. And the short answer is TBD. Stay tuned. It's probably not likely for a couple reasons. One, a mechanical all-wheel drive system in the car would take away from the whole intent of the car. You're adding a lot of cost and weight, the rear diff, the prop shaft, a different floor, a transfer case, all of that, and it's going to consume fuel. It's going to eat into fuel economy. The E all-wheel drive would be an interesting option, but that's also a fair amount of tear up into a program that's already in place. And but the other part of it is, this car, because it has the clearance, you know, it's interesting when you talk about, well, why do you really need all-wheel drive? Okay, I get that there's certain circumstances, off-roading and snowy conditions, but oftentimes it's the tread width and it's the ground clearance that really gets you through. There's a fellow in the office who talks about going 4x4ing, you know, way back in years ago, and there was a fellow who had a small pickup with the narrow, skinny tires that come on it, and he was able to go through a lot of stuff that the other guys couldn't because the footprint was so big. Now, on this car, we've taken it up into the mountains without chains, and literally before it was badged, the fellow at the ranger, the officer at the base of the highway before you go up would ask about all-wheel drive. And one of our engineers said, yeah, it's an Outback, of course.
And just going up to Tahoe?
Just going up and went up there and had no trouble with it. And the short answer was for a couple of reasons. One, it had the ground clearance. And two, it's also about throttle modulation. And so because of the torque down low and the linearity of the power delivery, you don't really need it for most of your driving instances. You know, full disclosure, yeah, it's a thing. A lot of people are asking for it. A lot of people want it. All-wheel drive. Big trend in the marketplace, but functionally, you can probably do just fine without it. Yeah.
Okay, they just sent me a message from the control room. We got a phone call that came in. Let's take that, and then we're going to have to wrap up.
Yeah, I'm actually looking to buy a Niro right now. I was actually looking to buy the Ioniq, but I didn't even know the Niro was out. And I'm actually looking right now because we're moving to Arizona, and I need a car. And I'm curious as to why the Hyundai has a lifetime warranty on the battery and the Kia does not on the Niro. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question. Be careful with your answer. You might have a sale here if you do it right.
Well, thank you for the interest in the car. We hope you buy one. If it was my call, I would get the launch edition personally. I think it looks the best. A little bit different wheel tire color combination. But so our cars powertrain is warranted for 10 years or 100,000 miles. And, you know, the fact is Hyundai Motor America is a different company. They have some traction in the marketplace with lifetime warranties on other vehicles, on other batteries, on other hybrids. So they elected to put that warranty in place. We're very confident in the powertrain and the battery and the durability, but we're very comfortable with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. And, you know, to be fair, the battery between the Ioniq and the Niro, it's essentially the same, 1.56 kilowatt hour lithium ion.
Yeah, very good. Steve, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap this up.
That was great.
I told you it would go fast.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's always going fast when you're having fun.
Yeah.
So thanks so much for coming in. Great to have the Niro here in the studio with us. But great
Thank
discussion.
You. Thank you, John. Great to be here. Gary, Christine.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, it was really great to be here. Thanks.
Okay, we're going to take a very quick break. We're coming back. We got a lot more to talk with. Dr. Data is going to make an appearance here, too.
Okay. I guess that's it.
Bridgestone engineers are helping All-Pro receiver Larry Fitzgerald go long.
I don't need help going long.
Bridgestone's Dual Relenza Plus is our longest-lasting SUV and truck tire. It's engineered to go 80,000 miles.
Huh? It's over 14 million first downs.
Oh, dang. I love anything that goes long. Long hair, long passes, long careers.
Long division.
Long dogs.
We're going to do this for 80,000 miles?
You can walk if you like.
I don't want to walk, Larry.
You don't have to.
Yes.
Long hugs, long weekends.
Okay, we're back. But I hope we helped make a sale here.
Could have gotten one. Yeah, absolutely. The guy calling up, that's a little unusual. for, you know, I'm in the market right now and I want to buy one.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully he made a U-turn and went back to the Kia dealer. Okay, it's that time of the show for the drum roll because it's time for Dr. Data.
Okay, so this is actually going to be somewhat thematic. So,
do you know how this works,
yes,
Dr.
I do.
Data? Okay,
yep.
We
yes.
didn't know if we had to explain it.
This is my first rodeo.
That's right. So Carmen, please bring up the first slide. Okay, 38,000, the year is 2015. Mm-hmm. What could have that been?
And we're seeing a bunch of traffic in the background.
You are.
Like some exhaust smoke.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take a stab at this. This is how many people prematurely died from pollution from cars.
You are right. I'm surprised. Well, actually, it's from excess diesel emissions.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I was surprised. So there was a study that was published this week in Nature magazine, and so according to them, on-road diesels produce approximately 20% of emissions of nitrogen oxide that are created by people, and they're precursors to the PM2.5 particles, those nasty little
bad
things
stuff.
In ozone. But what was interesting, and a number of other publications had picked this up, but what they seemed to indicate was, you know, that they were saying, oh, gee, it's cars. But basically what the study said is heavy-duty vehicles are the dominant contributor to excess diesel NOx emissions and associated health impacts. And
Class 8 trucks?
Like big trucks, yeah.
Okay.
On-road heavy-duty diesel
including
vehicles.
Locomotives and ships and all that.
Well, no, they were basically talking
about trucks
motor vehicles, yeah. And So basically they were saying that if Euro 6 regulations were applied, that would cause that to go way down. And but it's interesting that the excess emissions totaled 4.6 million tons.
Wow.
Pretty startling.
But, yeah. Wasn't there also a connection with the testing that's been done is not sufficient?
Well, they were saying that basically the lab testing and real-world testing
In Europe
are...
It's a joke. It's a total joke.
So far away from one another, and this is basically
this is why Volkswagen was able to fix its diesels in Europe and cannot fix their first-gen 2-liter diesels in the United States, because the European standards are crazy. And even though they've tightened them up, and now they're going to do a whole lot more on-road testing, because mm-hmm. that's where the real differences come between... You put it on in the lab and it looks great. You drive it on the road and not so good.
Mm-hmm.
The regulations allow, this is perfectly legal, for you to emit 2.1 times more emissions than the rules require you to meet in the lab. So this is what I don't get about Europe. In the U.S., diesels have to meet the exact same emission standards as gasoline engines. And our testing may not be the perfect, but it's relatively correlated to driving on the road. For most people, it does correlate well. Why doesn't Europe just mandate our standards?
Well, it's interesting. So this week, Volkswagen seemed to have settled with the 3-liter engine. So, you know, you're talking about the 2-liter diesel. Now it was the 3-liter.
But the V6 is okay.
So the bigger ones. And but it's interesting, in the release that Volkswagen put out about this, to your point exactly, regulations governing NOx emission limits for vehicles in the United States are much stricter than those in other parts of the world, and the engine variants also differ significantly. Here's the kicker. This makes the development of technical solutions in the United States more challenging than in Europe and other parts of the world. So,
yeah, look, I've been saying this all along. On paper, Euro 6, and what do they call it now, Euro 6B or something like that, look tougher than what we've got. I mean, if you look at the grams that you can emit per kilometer, grams per mile, HC, CO, NOx, PM2.5, PM10, Europe looks much, much stricter.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the testing, it's
right.
easy breezy. Anybody can get through on this stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Then there was, speaking of diesels, before we leave that subject, what do you make of the potential FCA lawsuit that the government may...
Look, I think FCA is in trouble, and I don't think it's just FCA. I think Daimler's next on the list. And I think what these companies have done. I'm just reading between the tea leaves. I haven't talked to anybody at EPA about this. But under certain operating conditions, you can let an engine temporarily exceed the emission limits. So if it's really hot and you got to put more fuel in the engine, if you're pulling a load, if you're going up a grade, you can temporarily allow the limits to be exceeded. But you have to report to the EPA that you've got these devices, the software control that allows it to happen. And FCA did not do that. And it looks like FCA had multiple software devices to allow this to happen and never notified EPA about it. And my guess is because there's been rumblings that Mercedes-Benz slash Daimler is in trouble over this too, that they're not going to be the only ones about it. So it's not a defeat device like Volkswagen had, which was deliberately there to trick the regulators into believing that the engine's clean. They just never reported to the EPA that under these and those and this other operating condition that the diesel will exceed emission standards.
All right. I don't know that I followed. So.
Okay.
Well, I think from FCA's vantage point, they didn't know because you said it's not a defeat device.
They knew.
Well, they didn't know that they had to.
I don't.
They didn't know they had to report?
Because it wasn't classified as they thought that they were within the parameters of what they could do, like you said, to protect the engine in certain operating conditions.
Yeah. My guess is they knew they were skirting the spirit of the law, even if maybe they didn't believe they were breaking the law. But, man, I think they're in trouble. Now, some have speculated it could cost them as much as $4.5 billion. I don't see EPA doing that to them. But, hey, maybe they'll get them to build a whole lot more charging stations.
But, like, I mean, but isn't this predicated, though, that the fine is levied per vehicle sold? So when you just do the math, it just that's where you come up with that big number?
Yeah, but, you know, everything's negotiable, right? So the max fine could be $4.5 billion. My guess is they're not going to pay that much.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think they are going to get fined.
And didn't Mercedes come out this week and say that they're not selling diesels in 2018 or 2018 model year?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that may be related to what we're talking about here. They probably know they're not going to get certification.
Mm-hmm. Either that or they just look at the fee for each vehicle sold with a diesel that breaks the law and it adds up too much. And so the profit margin would be very, very small. So.
Could be. Meanwhile, General Motors thinks that diesel sales in the U.S. market will double. Now, that includes trucks, but that's worth counting them.
What do you think, Christy?
I'm skeptical.
That it'll double?
Yeah. Oh. I mean, it's, well, double from where is the question.
Let's put it this way. Diesels right now account for 3% of the U.S. market. GM is saying that it could go to 5 or 6%.
I don't know. Every time I drive the Cruise diesel or I'm in a Cruise diesel, I just don't feel like the refinement is there, not the same. It's not as refined as the Volkswagen products were. So, and, you know, VW, Chevy customers, different psychographically, demographically. I wish them luck, but I don't know. I have my doubts.
I would agree with you on the passenger car side. I don't see the public clamoring for it. But on trucks, SUVs, which are a growing part of the market, diesels can be pretty compelling in those applications.
So, okay, so I can see the truck part. I can see, you know, Silverado, F-150, Ram 1500.
Yeah.
What SUV do you see getting one?
Oh, I would
Suburban?
See Suburban, Tahoe, Yukon, Escalade, talking just the GM products.
Yeah.
Ford's going to be putting a diesel in the F-150. That's just around the corner. So when you start looking at that and seeing that, you know, the utility and the pickup side of the market continues to grow, I don't know if GM's right or not, but I could see more diesels being sold there.
I'm sort of with you on this one.
Yeah.
Okay, the skeptics rule.
So this was a big week. Speaking of Ford, this whole notion of 10% cut in their North American and Asia Pacific white collar. That sort of surprised me. I mean, it seems to me that Ford has been fairly rigorous post-recession, I don't think that they've added a whole lot of excess people. And, you know, 10% is not a trivial number.
No.
So, I mean, what's going on here?
Well, they've added a lot of engineers in the fields of autonomy and electrification and infotainment. I don't know. Maybe they have added more than... Maybe it has added up to 10% more, but those people aren't going to be the ones losing their jobs.
No, they're not going to do it at all.
No.
Look, last week, we know because it got out that the board of directors was having a scheduled meeting, and they scheduled extra time for Ford's CEO, Mark Fields, to brief them on how he was going to accelerate all their plans or make whatever changes is needed to boost their margins, to get their stock price going, which is going absolutely nowhere. I see this directly coming out of that meeting, that they've got to announce some amount of headcount. Now, I don't know if Ford really planned this out because it leaked. The Wall Street Journal broke the story. And it first came out they were getting rid of 10% of all their employees. And everybody jumped and looked it up and said, oh, they got 200,000 employees. They're getting rid of 20,000 people. And then the next day, Ford put out a statement saying we're going to get rid of 1,400 people. And so I think, you know, there's this big panic when the 20,000 number comes out. Oh, my God, 20,000. Blah, blah, blah. And then it's like 1,400. Oh, that's nothing. No big deal.
But does it stop at 1,400, though? I mean, this might just be the first strike.
It could be. But I see this directly coming out of the pressure that Wall Street is putting on the company. And my advice to Ford is tell Wall Street to go to hell. Because Wall Street never rewarded the company over the last 5 years when it posted record profits. Mm-hmm. The stock did nothing. So what makes anybody think that if they go back to record profits, the stock's going to change at all? And it's the same thing for General Motors, which is under even more pressure than Ford. And the reason it is because all the activist investors know that the Ford family controls 40% of the voting stock, and they're never going to get anywhere in trying to take over the company.
So how much of this do you think was predicated on the valuation of Tesla beating Ford?
Well, yeah, this is a huge embarrassment for all the car companies that a company like Tesla, which has never posted a profit for any of the 16 years it's been in business, doubled its debt load in the last year, is burning through cash at an astonishing rate, has a valuation greater than General Motors, which is posting all-time record profits.
But Tesla's the future, and Ford and GM are the past. I think that's the way that Wall Street looks at it.
No, I think you're right there, Christy. But, you know, Wall Street always says, we're not grading you on how you're doing now. It's always about the future. But if you go back 4 years ago, it was pretty obvious GM and Ford were going to lay some serious cash down on the bottom line, and their stock did nothing.
Mm-hmm. So I was looking trust me, I know nothing about stock. But the highest price for Ford stock in the last several years was $17.72, and that occurred on July 18th, 2014.
That's about the day Alan Mulally left, right?
Yeah.
Fields took over on July 1st, 2014, and if you look at their stock price, it's been, you know, I mean, there's been some ups and downs.
Here's something else to consider, and I think this is something that Wall Street has not looked at. In fact, I don't even think Ford has done this. One of the ways of measuring the value of a company is its price to earnings ratio. So you look at, for every dollar in earnings, what will the market pay above that for your stock? So for the S&P 500 right now, it's 22-1. So for every dollar you put down on an earnings per share, they'll pay you $22 on top of that to buy your stock. Okay, so P.E. ratio is it. Ford has the highest P.E. ratio of any car company in the world. Any car company in the world. Their P.E. ratio is twice that as General Motors. Now, it still sucks. It's half the S&P average. But it's the best in the world. And people go, well, what's Tesla's P.E. ratio? Tesla does not have a P.E. ratio because they have no earnings. Mm-hmm. So you can't have
a price-to-earnings ratio.
Right. You just have the price part. But I think this is a point that should be made, that you're picking on a company that has the best P.E. ratio in the world. You never rewarded them whatsoever for posting record profits. Get the hell out of this industry. I mean, go find other industries to invest in. I hate to break the news to you, but the auto industry, you're just never going to reward it. I don't care what it does.
So what do you think the consequences going forward will be for Mark Fields?
He's under enormous pressure. I mean, I heard the rumors last fall that he might get thrown out. I don't believe it for a second for some of the reasons that I just cited, but the talk is out there that Mark could be on the way out. As I said, I don't buy into this for a second.
What do you think, Chrissy?
I think he'll stick around. Yeah, I it's just a feeling I have. You know, he's relatively young. He's only been on the job 3 years. They do have a lot of great plans for the future. I know Wall Street's very skeptical about those plans, about autonomy and mobility, but they're making record profits on trucks and SUVs right now.
You know, it almost seems to me that you know, that part of the business, the sort of the bread and butter, mm-hmm. is what's really doing well, and that his turning it into a mobility company, which I certainly agree that they need to look in that direction, I think that may be his Achilles heel in all this.
Well, remember, it's his, but it's also Bill Ford's. I mean, Bill Ford is the one who really set the vision for the company to go after this. So, you know, you can't just plop this all in Mark Fields' lap, you know. And the board went along with all these investments.
But what's mm-hmm. Bill's last name?
Yeah. F-O-R-D.
Yeah, he ain't going anywhere.
I know, so. He's not going anywhere. But, you know, this is part of the problem that the auto industry faces. It's very capital intensive. It's cyclical. It takes years to pay off on those investments. I personally think that if they had not made all these investments in mobility and autonomy, everyone would say, yep, same old stupid dump, right. You know, bump on a log Detroit mentality. Mm-hmm. Instead, GM and Ford, in my opinion, are at the forefront of any car company in this, except maybe Tesla, but it's in a class of its own being so small. So for the major guys,
price, no earnings.
Yeah, right, right. But I really like what GM and Ford are doing these days. I think it's going to pay off in the long run. I think the activist investors should sell, move on, and visit us again in 10 years.
So speaking of General Motors, so they announced that basically they're going to stop selling cars in India. They're going to still continue to make cars in India, which I thought was sort of interesting because that it is their manufacturing facility in India is an export hub to Mexico and Central and South American markets. That just seemed really wild to me that you would send cars from India to Mexico. I mean, it's just, geez. South Africa is going away. East Africa, geez. So. What's going on there?
What do you think, Chris?
The incredible shrinking General Motors. They've tried, you know. I think they've tried for years in these markets, and they've come to the conclusion that it's not worth it. Not worth it to stay. But it certainly makes their business riskier because they're now, you know, what do they have? They have China, they have the U.S., Canada, Mexico, you know.
South America.
South America. If the market goes south in these regions...
Yeah.
You know, if you had more regions, you could balance
because
the risk.
Because they sold Opel to PSA, so they basically have foregone their European business.
Yeah,
yeah, I think it's a real risk. You know, at the time that they're pulling out of Europe because they don't see any end to the losses, mm-hmm. Ford, on the other hand, has just reported all-time record profits in Europe. Mm-hmm. That's got to rub them one way. India, you know, everybody perceives India is looking at fantastic growth in the future. They pulled out of Russia, GM did, too, from a manufacturing standpoint. They're still mm-hmm. selling Chevys there, but Russia's starting to make a bit of a comeback right now, even with all the sanctions and low oil prices. My question is, would today's General Motors have invested in China 20 years ago? With the mindset that they have now, would they go, China, small market, you know, they all ride bicycles. I don't see any value going in there.
Yeah.
And that's the danger I see in GM's strategy. I admire their discipline. I really do. Of saying, hey, look, we can't make money here. Why waste it?
Mm-hmm.
But I also wonder if they're missing opportunity here. Not right now, but in the future.
Yeah. well, they could always re-enter the market. You know, they could rebadge. They could do a deal with another automaker and rebadge some vehicles as Chevys if they want to get the brand back into these markets. But
you know one reason why Buick's so successful right now today? Because they invested in Buick 20 years ago. And to say, oh, wow, we'll just go back into the market. Wow. And when you've given everybody else such a big head start, I'm not so sure it's that easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting. What was it? Volvo just announced that they're going to start manufacturing in India.
Yeah.
So, so General Motors will continue to manufacture. They're just not going to sell there.
And the reasoning for not selling was interesting. They said to offer a full line of vehicles, which is what it takes to have a healthy dealership network, just was not going to work. They couldn't see how they could make money in with that kind of investment. So it's surprising that they'll continue to manufacture in India. It must be awfully cheap to make cars there and ship them to Mexico.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? I mean, that's just unbelievable.
Because did you guys see, you know, it came out in a Bloomberg story last week, BMW is paying its entry-level workers in Mexico $1.10 an hour. I about threw up when I read that. I couldn't believe it. I can't believe that they'd pay, you know, that works out to about $2,300 a year.
From a company that could afford to pay a lot more than...
A whole lot more,
yeah.
Right.
Speaking of how car companies are doing, so the 17th annual OEM Supplier Relationship Index came out, and no surprise that Toyota is at the top, as it has been for every year they've been doing this, with the exception of 2 years when Honda beat them. But it's like there's always been Honda and Toyota have been up here. And then you get down to the middle tier of companies, and then you get to the lower tier of companies. And so just if we have Toyota at 328, that's what they score.
Mm-hmm.
Nissan scored 203.
And going down fast.
So you cover the Asians. What do you see going on here?
So Nissan is a very multicultural company, which is not a bad thing. But if you look at the leadership of Honda and Toyota, you still have a lot of Japanese in the top positions. And, you know, respect for individuals, respect for others imbues everything that they do. I was actually just at Toyota yesterday at TTC. They've developed this new supplier center, multi-million-dollar supplier center. And the whole thing is, like, you guys come in here, you have free reign. Supply, you know, when you come in for a meeting, suppliers, you can go anywhere. We've got workstations for you. You're our partner. You're our friend. You know, let's look at your parts designs. Let's try to figure out a way that we can both save costs. You know, we'll redesign this. And, you know, so there's this, you know, spirit of collaboration that exists, I think, at Toyota and Honda that you don't get so much at Nissan. And I don't know. That was my first thought, is that the leadership is a bit more diverse. People from other regions that
they just put a new guy in charge of purchasing at Nissan North America, and he's Japanese.
Okay, well, maybe things will be changing.
Carlos Ghosn sets the stage or the tone for the whole company, and he has said we're going to have 10% market share, 10% margins. Now, all you troops, go out and make it so. And I think Nissan's playing hardball, just demanding price cuts. Mm-hmm. Just flat out cut your price. Not your cost. You can do that if you want, but you got to cut the price. Meanwhile, if you look at the ones who are doing well, Toyota and Honda, as you mentioned, and GM, which is rocketing up the charts under the leadership of Steve Kiefer, who I think is terrific what he's doing. And he's doing the very things that you've been talking about, Christy.
Right.
Respect for the individual, you know, from the buyer to the supplier, more collaboration. Collaboration, and especially in how do we take cost out collectively?
Mm-hmm.
And supplier, you get to keep a chunk of those savings.
Mm-hmm.
So you're motivated to come up with these savings.
Right.
And so I think that's what's going on at Nissan, is they're under the gun right now. We know that their fleet sales are going up tremendously. We know they've got some of the highest incentives going right now. They're beating up their suppliers. I mean, that's the way GM used to be.
So what does this do to, I mean, the product? I mean, most people care about the car they buy, the truck they buy,
the crossover they buy. They don't necessarily care about, you know, what Planning Perspectives Inc. measures and you know what John Hankey has found this year. I mean, they care about, okay, I'm gonna buy a car. So what does this mean when I buy a Nissan? Does it mean anything?
It could mean fewer features in vehicles. You know, suppliers like to give their newest, most innovative products to automakers that they have the best relationships with, the automakers that they know that are going to be, you know, not hammering them. So
I got to say, I really like Nissan's lineup. I think their products are pretty good. You know, just because you treat your suppliers badly doesn't mean your cars are going to be bad. But where it will show up is Nissan buying the cheapest stuff possible? That may lead to more warranty claims. If there's a warranty problem and you've just beat me up and now you call me and I've got a problem, you got to come help me. And I'm thinking, well, I've got these other customers who treat me very well. I'll come help you when I get done with the guys who treat me well, i.e., maybe you don't jump on a warranty issue or get it resolved as quickly if you're beating up your suppliers. And to your point, Christy, the suppliers you have great relations with will bring their best ideas and their best technology to you first. Mm-hmm. Then they'll go shop it elsewhere. And that's where these things start to show up. Or what's your thoughts, Gary?
Well, I mean, I think that basically if somebody's nice to you, you give them your better technology and you get around to selling it to the other guys later on because, you know, mm-hmm. they're interested in price and only price. They're not interested in this collaboration or, you know, how can we work with you and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that will end up biting them in the rear end at some point, them being Nissan. I don't know if you're going to see it next year, but, you know, and especially as, you know, the thing that strikes me is that, you know, as we get more electronics and software into vehicles, that these are things that traditional car companies are not all that apt with mm-hmm. and comfortable with and don't have the engineering teams to develop internally yeah. and that they need to go to the outside for that. And all the suppliers, you know, whether it's Delphi or Bosch or Continental or you know, mm-hmm. you name it, you know, these companies have seen the writing on the wall a number of years. They've developed the skill set. So, you know, if you know that, gee, I got to go call on Nissan and they're going to come, you know, they're going to beat me up today versus, oh, I'm going to call on Honda or Toyota or General Motors and they're going to work with me today. How's this going to be? You know what I mean? And yeah. And I mean, and that technology becomes essential. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, the content of a car with the stuff that isn't mechanical, the stuff that isn't a seat, the stuff that isn't a headliner, the stuff that isn't a steel panel, is going to be all the more important. And man,
Nissan already trails the competition on that sector. I mean, HMI, you know, I think they have some of the worst HMI right now in the industry. Small screens, very dated graphics and systems, and so that could be a danger point.
Could be a real problem. One of the things, a number that really struck me was, and even Honda's got to be shaking its head at this. So one of the areas that they looked at was how do people feel about different subsections of the car body and white chassis, electronics, exterior, interior, powertrain. So in the electronics category, Toyota scores 455, okay? Honda scores 355, okay? There's 100 points between the two top companies. Then you go down to Ford, which is at 290. Our friend Hao Tai Tang is the purchasing guy over there. GM 274, FCA 228, Nissan 191.
Wow.
455, 191.
Yeah, so a huge gap. That's what they call statistically significant.
Yeah, so who's going to have the best electronics in their vehicles 2 or 3 years down the road?
Looks like Toyota.
Man, and who's not going to? It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're getting close to the using up our allotted time here. You got any other topic, Gary, or Christy?
Well,
then?
Well, Gary and I both drove the new Honda Odyssey recently. It's in a sector that is shrinking by the day. I understand Nissan just officially made it official that the Quest is gone. But
when did that happen?
This past week.
Really? I didn't see that.
Yeah.
Of course, it was a dud in the market. It never worked.
It was, but, you know, every time I get in a minivan, I just think this is the perfect vehicle type. You know, it can't get any better than this. They're just so easy to live with, you know, easy step-in height, really comfortable, lots of gadgetry, and, you know, in the new Odyssey, the seats slide laterally, and then you can push the seat forward as well when it's slid inward, and just a lot of really cool features, and I liked it. What did you think of it?
No, I mean I agree with you. I mean it's I mean I think the minivan is I think it's gonna make a comeback thanks to Waymo and working with Pacifica.
Oh yeah, for ride sharing.
I honestly think that is going to become a vehicle, an architecture for all the reasons that you cited. Because you know, it's got the easy ingress egress. It's got, you know, it's got seats that can move around, so you know, you can get into one of these things, put your child seats in there, and so on and so forth. I mean, and do that sort of thing, and you know. It's one of these things. I mean, you look at what Honda's been doing, you know, for generation over generation over generation. I mean, they've been you know, right at it, not stinting at all on this, basing it on much of the architecture that the MDX that we've had in the studio, in the Ridgeline architecture that, you know, the pickup which we did the show on. So It's like they refine, okay, and they just make it better and better and better. And, you know, I think it's a worthy competitor to the Pacifica. And the Pacifica, I think, just, you know, went
skyrocketed.
You know, yeah. Just above
it's awesome.
Beyond everybody else.
It is awesome.
So now we got to see what Toyota comes up with and how Kia does, because they're the only ones left, right?
That's right.
Yep.
There's only four.
Well, Dodge Grand Caravan. Yeah.
Well, I mean, but that's
the grand old Caravan.
That's a legacy product. But I mean, so basically Pacifica,
Sienna,
Odyssey,
Sedona.
Yeah,
you know, I was looking at the sales figures for last year. Sedona and Grand Caravan were the only two that increased last year. No, I shouldn't say that, because the Odyssey did go up last year by like 6%, but the increases for Sedona and Grand Caravan were like 20 and 25%. So I think that shows that there's a real need still for a value minivan.
A cheap one.
Yes, a cheap minivan.
Because, yeah, the ones that we're all drooling over can be pretty pricey. I mean, you can easily get into a $45,000 minivan, which, you know, just makes my head spin. But as we were just talking about, they're awfully nice.
Yeah, no, they're, you know, probably if we made a ratio of pound, size, and cost, that they're probably a great deal.
Yeah, fuel economy still isn't great, but
yeah. Yeah, but there's like pushing a brick through the air. I mean, what do you want?
Well, one way to measure it too is, you know, put six or seven people in it, and then look at the amount of fuel burned per passenger mile.
Good point.
And all of a sudden, they don't look so bad. In fact, they look as good as a Prius almost in that regard. But the other thing about minivans, why they work, I think, is, number one, they have a long wheelbase. A, that means they ride better. Mm-hmm. B, it's a big box. So not only does it have a lot of room, but for a sound system, the bigger the container it's in, the better the sound's going to be. So right off the bat, they're more comfortable and they sound better inside from a music standpoint. So
yeah,
there's just something about that package that works. And I agree, Gary. I think for ride sharing, those things are really going to come alive.
The stigma may go away.
Yeah. What do you think of the sheet metal flourish on the Odyssey? I call it the boomerang on the door.
The lightning bolt?
Well, no. The lightning bolt is... they've smoothed that out now. This is like a whole new indentation.
I quite honestly think that it is
overwrought.
No, it's just
to me, it's overwrought.
It just seems to me a flourish that they felt that they had to add to the thing to give it a little bit of style. I think that if you look at that,
there we go. We got the picture up on it. I think that just looks hideous. I'm sorry. I don't know. I'm talking about the whole van. I'm just not a fan of Honda styling. I love the cars.
Yeah.
I don't like the styling.
Yeah, I mean, the Pacifica is just the standard, I think, right now, and I think they fall pretty short of that on style. They did do a nose job, they said. Basically, they had to, for aero reasons, had to carve the nose up a little bit more. So I think it's a little, proportionally, it looks a little off now compared to how it used to look before. But the funniest comment I read this week online, because the vehicle came off embargo this week, so all the reviews were up, somebody said, why does it already look like it's been T-boned? Which was probably not the comment, the reaction they were going for.
See, the form language just doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
Just not to my eyes. And they'll go on to sell record amounts of them. So take my comments with a grain of salt. Mm-hmm.
They're saying 125 annual volume.
That's a nice
is what
volume.
They're looking for, which is
that's
a pretty good
plant.
Pretty good volume. Yeah.
Well, guys, we ought to wrap it up here.
All right.
Yeah, but good show. Very interesting. I liked having Steve on, too. Mm-hmm. That was good, talking all about the Nero.
Mm-hmm.
Christy, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, John.
Great having you. And Gary, let's just keep on doing this.
We'll do one next week.
Okay. It's a deal. I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.